It's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 83 for Friday the 6th of July, 2012. On the show today, did this week contain the biggest scientific discovery in decades? It looks like it could well have been, and we'll explain why. Plus, marijuana without its associated high is now possible thanks to medical research teams in Israel. You may wonder why, but a lot of people could benefit from this. And which legendary Japanese video game is getting a modern re-release? We'll tell you that and more as we level up on this week's epic collection of Wired News. Ahoy hoy to the hoy hoy, Nate Langson here, editor of Wired.co.uk. Joining me as always, news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello.
Hi. And Olivia underscore Solon.
Hello.
Now, I put in my little notes here, no time for banter this week. Banter declined because we've got so much to get through, but I have one thing to say. Happy birthday, Liv.
Thanks.
Liv's birthday today.
Happy birthday, Liv.
Well, it'll be yesterday if you're listening to it tomorrow.
I feel like I should be giving you this clementine instead of eating it myself.
But okay, you don't have to. You took us all out for lunch.
I did, actually. That's true. I'll keep the clementine. Thanks. Okay, anyway, we're going to crack on with some news. Got some amazing stuff this week. The first is that the biggest news in science for decades possibly did actually happen this week. You'll have been hard-pressed to have missed it. Two experiments at the physics lab CERN have observed a new particle in the mass region around 125 to 126 giga electron volts, which is consistent with the elusive Higgs boson, Duncan.
Okay, what on earth does that all mean?
What that means is that... But basically, the Higgs boson has eluded scientists pretty much consistently. One of the jobs of the giant £6 billion particle collider at CERN was to find it, which it looks like it has done.
Okay, but what is the Higgs boson?
Oh, what is the Higgs boson? Okay,
let's start there, because I think there are a lot of people this week who were like, oh yeah, Higgs boson now, what the hell is that all about?
Higgs boson in a nutshell. Basically, we know that atoms have mass. We know that, but we actually don't know why they have mass. We don't know where that mass arises from or how they get mass or different types of mass, basically. It was hypothesized, actually, by Peter Higgs, who was a physicist at Edinburgh University, that as atoms go through this mysterious thing called the Higgs field, kind of like, I don't know, a bean going through some heavy water, maybe, that's basically how it gets its mass. And one of the signature particles of this is something called a Higgs boson. And if we find that, we basically confirm that Higgs was correct. And that's how we get mass.
Now, Peter Higgs is still alive, of course. And there were some wonderful shots of him at the press conference where it was announced and everything.
There were.
He seemed really, really proud of the fact that his discovery, which initially was rejected by a lot of the scientific community, has finally been, well, not 100% validated, but 99.999999%. validated.
This is the thing. So, I mean, what they've, a spokesperson actually for CERN said that this is indeed a new particle. We know it must be a boson, and it's the heaviest boson ever found. They've got this sliding scale that sort of shows how likely a result that they've seen happened just because of random chance, or whether they've actually seen something that really they were looking for. In this case, the Higgs boson.
And that can be obviously pumped up by the certainty levels can be pumped up by just repeating the experiment over and over and over again. And obviously, the more times you do it, the more likely it is that the more unlikely it is that those results could have just arisen by chance. So the reason this has taken such a long time is because the teams on Atlas and on, what's the other one called?
CMS.
Yes. The teams have been repeating it over and over and over again to build up this confidence level to a stage where they can say, yes, this is actually a new particle.
Yeah.
There's no chance of, or very tiny, tiny, tiny amounts of chance, because there's never no chance.
Yeah.
It having just materialized by chance.
The world was pretty much in awe, because this does look like the Higgs. It's pretty damn certain that that's what this is. It's an amazing day, Liv. Well, week. Yeah.
Well, it is. My birthday and the Higgs discovery. I mean, that is the axis of accomplishment.
So, obviously, the Large Hadron Collider was built, you know, in large part to try and find this thing. What's it going to do now that they've found it? Are they just going to shut down and go home?
Well, no, I mean, they still have more tests to do to sort of increase that certainty level to make sure that what they're looking at is correct. And then, obviously, I mean, they'll still keep using it. It's not like the Millennium Dome. They're not going to sell it off to be a giant skate tube or something. No,
the O2 CERN.
Yeah, that would be great. No, there are still more tests on this to do, and they need to analyze the data more and make absolutely certain, you know, you're not going to see it necessarily on the front page that, you know, physics changes just quite yet, but it's looking that way.
I think there was a bit of disappointment as well, because what this this discovery does is it kind of not wholly invalidates, but it makes it much, there are certain other scientific theories much less likely. Things like supersymmetry and things like that were posited as explanations for what could have happened if we didn't manage to find the Higgs boson. And so now we found it, there's a few researchers who are probably going to be a little bit disappointed. But it's at the same time, you know, science is science. If we found something, that's a good thing for everyone, for humanity.
Well, the bottom line is that even if this doesn't turn out to be the Higgs boson, the fact is they've discovered a new particle and it's the heaviest of its class they've ever found. That in itself is amazing. But I mean, if anyone is sort of thinking, oh, I don't care about this, it's not that interesting, this is genuinely huge, 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 huge news for science. And we should be following it quite closely, and will, in fact. But let's move on. Liv, I want to talk about pot. Medicinal marijuana, specifically.
Medicinal marijuana, indeed. And an Israeli team has developed a special type of medical marijuana that doesn't get you high.
Why?
Well, that's a very good question. A lot of people in Israel, medical marijuana is legal. I think about 9,000 people have a license to use it from the government. And it's used for lots of different ailments to treat kind of chronic pain and inflammation. So MS, it's used for some cancer patients. And it's also can help kind of stimulate appetites of patients who haven't been able to eat properly. However, a lot of people who take this medicinal marijuana don't want to get stoned. They're not 14. They just want to have the palliative effect of the drug, the anti-inflammatory effect that comes from one substance within marijuana, but not the kind of doping effect of another substance.
Not totally dissimilar to people who like the taste of coffee but don't like the feeling of having caffeine in their blood.
Exactly. So a company called Tikkun Olam, which is a company that manufactures this medical marijuana, has divided up the two, has isolated the two kind of compounds within it. So there's THC, which is the stuff that makes you high, and that's the stuff that's been increasing over time in weed that you can buy on the street, and has led the Daily Mail to call it, you know, super skunk. And then there's a cannabidiol, which is CBD, which is the compound that's meant to have the kind of anti-inflammatory advantages, which is useful to treat these chronic conditions. And so the strain they've created has a negligible amount of the THC, I think less than 1%, and then a huge amount of the CBD, 15.8%. And this means that you can have amazing benefits for on the kind of treatment side without feeling stoned.
So can they actually manufacture this? Is this something
they are? They're making it. It's called Adivekel. Is the strain that they're selling it. They are also at the same time researchers at the Hebrew University are studying it, but it's already on sale and that people can already buy it.
Awesome.
Is it possible to just kind of extract the cannabidiol itself and just kind of put that in a pill and have people take that?
I think that is a difficult process. It's easier to take it as the natural, the thing you can grow and just dry, and rather than trying to extract it from
the
plant.
So these people will still be smoking it or cooking with it or whatever?
No, they have it in pill form as well, okay. Just eating it, but without the effects of being monged out for the rest of the day.
Right. Speaking of monged out... The European government. We've got two stories we want to touch upon here quickly. One is that, well, Duncan, why don't you explain this? Interesting revelation in terms of reselling software.
Yeah, the EU has made an interesting and slightly odd ruling about whether it's possible to sell used software. They've declared that digitally distributed software can be resold as used just like a physical product can.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing. You can buy a CD in the street, you can listen to it, and you then have the right of first sale. You can take it to a shop. It's perfectly, perfectly legal, but it becomes really difficult with software for obvious reasons. How do you sell something that doesn't physically exist?
Yes, exactly. This discussion kind of stemmed out of a spat between Oracle and a company called UsedSoft, who resell product licenses for Oracle software after they've been bought from Oracle customers. Oracle obviously didn't like this because they thought they should have been getting a chunk of that money, but so it went to the EU, and the EU said that the copyright holder loses all distribution rights the moment it sells a copy of its software to the customer, whether that's on a physical medium like a DVD or a CD, or whether it's distributed through downloads on a website or something like that. And if a customer does decide to sell his digital copy, and this is the interesting bit, he must make the copy, this is a quote, make the copy downloaded onto his own computer unusable at the time of resale. Now, that's an intriguing thing.
Yeah, because, I mean, firstly, how do you prove that?
Yes, definitely. And obviously, this also kind of like opens the door to extra horrible DRM that will be slathered all over software in the future, because companies could say, well, you know, we need to be able to invalidate it if somebody decides to sell it or something like that. But we're still quite far away from that point. A media lawyer called Jaz Purewal at a company called Osborne Clark told us that the case raises more questions than it answers. We're not really in a clear-cut situation at all, he said. He said there's going to need to be some kind of legal catalyst to spark change. A first case against one of the platform holders, somebody like iTunes or Steam or somebody that kind of like sells software or even Apple, you know, if you want to sell an app that you've downloaded after you're done with it. But yeah, it's there's going to need to be this kind of like legal case to force them to include that functionality in their software.
I can't imagine that somewhere like Amazon or iTunes would want to facilitate reselling of digital software. It works when Amazon sells Amazon resells a physical CD on its marketplace, because it doesn't have to do any inventory stock or stock management or anything like that. All they do is take a cut of the total sale. Whereas with digital, it's all just virtual.
Well, I'm that's sure the thing. That's why I think they might be actually quite interested in getting into this, because if they can take a cut a second time, from you know the same process,
then it's instead of selling a new copy.
Yes, but then if Apple's getting the same cut either way, they really don't care. It's more the developers who created the product in the first place that have something to worry about here.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. But it has ramifications across all digital media, not just music or apps. But I mean, like you say, games and TV shows and everything like that. And I think it's going to be a really interesting one to follow this, for sure.
Yeah, it's very, very early days still. And it's possible that the ruling might get invalidated at a later point. But yeah, for the time being, it's an interesting one.
Well, speaking of rulings with a frowny face drawn all over them, Acta Live. We've not been fans of Acta, have we, you and I?
We haven't in particular. This is the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement that is supposed to protect the copyright and intellectual property of content creators across Europe. But it wasn't very popular because it was rushed through, very vague and very open to misinterpretation. Well, finally, after many, many months of various votes and lots of protests, the European Parliament has rejected the agreement by a huge majority, 478 votes to 39. And it's actually the first time that the Parliament has exercised its Lisbon Treaty power to reject an international trade agreement that had already been agreed by the whole of the EU member states and a number of other countries, including the US, Australia and Canada and Japan, etc.
As interesting as that is on its own, what I really like about this story as well is that the EU recognised unprecedented direct lobbying, this is a quote again, by thousands of EU citizens who call to reject ACTA, probably the first time that people have been excited about EU legislation.
Yeah.
That's
amazing.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We were having a discussion about Slacktivism the other day on the podcast. Yeah. And was that last week or the week before? I can't remember.
Yeah,
I think it was last week.
And this proves that, yeah, it does work.
This wasn't really Slacktivism because people came out to the streets with this. Which I think moved on from Slacktivism to activism. But they did also recognise the petition that they'd received with 2.8 million votes. So I think they must be pretty excited that democracy for the European Union is working.
The US is still going to join in this thing, though, aren't they?
It has already, yes.
Oh, it has already.
And Japan, Mexico, Morocco, New Zealand, Singapore, South Korea and Switzerland.
Off the top of your head.
Yeah.
So will these people actually... So the list of countries that you just read out, are they going to actually implement the trade agreement still? Or does it have to be a global thing?
I don't think it has to be a global thing.
The EU isn't involved, so it doesn't apply to us.
It doesn't apply to the EU, but I think the other countries can maintain this trade agreement if they so wish.
Well, good news if you hate ACTA, which is to say most people who know about ACTA who aren't in government. Duncan, let's talk about deep sea worms, please. They've been melting bones.
Yeah, it's quite far away from European legislation. Deep sea worms that live inside dead whale skeletons on the seabed have this unique ability, scientists have discovered, to release bone-melting acid.
It's brilliant. This is in here, not necessarily because we think most people are going to be interested in the actual news, but because this happens in the world.
Yeah, pretty much.
Bone-melting worms.
Yeah, these worms are called Osedax worms. They're 4 centimetres long at most. Some of them are a lot smaller. They don't have any mouth, they don't have any anus, they don't have any gut, they don't have any body parts that could be used to drill through bone. So what the scientists wanted to do is find out how on earth they were breaking down these skeletons.
And how did they?
I'm glad you asked. The team were looking for enzymes that kind of secrete acid in various different tissues of the worms, and they found one of these enzymes, which is a protein pump that was abundant in particular part of the worm that penetrates the bone. This enzyme release kind of demineralizes the bone. It chews out the calcium and so on, creating this hole in the skeleton that reveals the fat and the oil that's inside, and then the bacteria that's part of the worm digests that fat and releases nutrients that it can absorb and, you know, continue to exist with.
So it's not so much eating it as it is basically
absorbing it.
Yeah, dissolving and
absorbing. Correct.
A thing that dissolves it and then kind of somehow absorbs it through, I suppose it's just the skin on the outside of it.
Yeah, but in quite an interesting kind of development on this, it's only actually the female worms that have got these acidic enzymes. The males are teeny tiny. They never really grow beyond about a millimetre long. And they live in a kind of gelatinous tube that surrounds each female.
Wow. A
single female will generally have hundreds of males living in her little tube.
Ooh,
and then reproduces with them from time to time.
There's a dream. That's frightening, Duncan.
Yeah.
Can you make a movie of it?
Yeah, all right.
Well, don't we have a photo actually on the site? We have a photo on the site.
I think we have a photo on the site.
Know.
Yeah.
I genuinely don't know, but I think we do have a picture of that. Frightening stuff. Thanks for that image in my brain.
You're welcome.
Area. I just want to briefly mention something that excited me. It got my I put my excitement pants firmly on here, because Final Fantasy VII, quite possibly one of the greatest things ever made, let's not beat around the bush here, it's bloody brilliant, a Japanese role-playing game from 1997, is being re-released on the PC quote soon, according to its developer Square Enix. Now this is, for anyone who doesn't know, this is a game that was released 15 years ago that still ends up on people's best game ever lists, even today. It was kind of it was a genre-defining title in its era. It still serves as a benchmark in terms of storytelling and what can be done with video games. And people still play, you know, these old games time and time again.
But it's been difficult to play this game on the PC for quite some time. It's been buggy. It's been difficult to get running on modern graphics cards.
That's
and
true.
So what Square Enix is doing is trying to basically make it more accessible. They're going to be selling it through their online store. Is that right?
Yes, the Square Enix store, at least to begin with. We think it might end up on Steam after that.
Yes, possibly. It'll have a selection of new features in it. There'll be achievements. There'll be ways to save your progress in the cloud so that you can carry on multiple computers, and also an interesting thing that lets you max out your character's stats so that you can just push through and play the story, which I was a little bit
I
think a lot of people are a bit curious about this. There aren't that many details around.
I'm actually quite disappointed in this, unless it's implemented for no cost, because what makes these games great is that it does take quite a large amount of sort of building up your character. You have to, you know, there's a lot of enemies to fight,
grinding, it's known as in the genre.
Yeah, and by sort of removing that as a kind of as a hurdle, then you're just reducing the game to its story, which is great, but it doesn't make the game necessarily as good as the game was when it first came out. It's always an option, but I fear they're going to charge for it.
I'm worried that it might kind of ruin some of the pacing of the game, because the pacing is some of the most beautiful aspects of Final Fantasy VII.
It really is. It's not a remake, though. We should point that out. A lot of people have called for a remake of the game with modern graphics. That's not what this looks to be. It is just a sort of a slightly tweaked version for modern machines, and it will also be on the PS Vita later this year, as a side note. Very exciting, Duncan.
Who was always in your party? Who were your other two characters?
Mine were always probably, I think, Tifa and Barret, but I always liked Red, the little wolf guy, quite a lot, because he was quite a strong physical character.
Okay, I often played with Yuffie and, what was he called, Vincent.
I can see Liv's eye sort of glazing over, going,
There's probably going to be a few listeners who are eyes
glazing
over.
I'm just thinking of zombie worms and unicorns.
I think it's probably time we move on then. Another interesting story here, Liv. Smart headlights. I've never heard of a smart headlight.
No. Well, a big challenge when driving in the rain at night is that the headlights will bounce off if there's a lot of rain, will bounce off it and cause a kind of a glare, which makes it very difficult for the driver to see.
They should glue those lights better onto the front of the car if they're bouncing.
They really should. Yeah. And a team at Carnegie Mellon's Robotics Institute has kind of come up with a solution to this problem that doesn't happen a huge amount of the time. But they've developed these headlights that can detect raindrops or snowflakes, and then they use the word disilluminate them. Now, what this means is they will have these headlights that send out a kind of quick flash of light that will locate all of the pieces of precipitation in front of the car. They'll then process that information using an algorithm that can kind of predict where the drops will be a few milliseconds later, and then shine another light very quickly behind that, which is kind of like a kind of, it projects the light in black and white, black where the drops of rainfall or snow drops will be, and light everywhere else. So, i.e. they don't light up those small points where the precipitation is.
That's going to be have to be crazy fast.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. At the moment, the whole process takes about 13 milliseconds, which is fast, but not that fast when you're talking about driving at any great speed. So at about 30 kilometres per hour, which, let's face it, is pretty damn slow, it will block out about 70% of the rainfall. But at 100 kilometres per hour, which is probably what most people drive at, if, especially if you're going at any kind of speed on a motorway, only 15 to 20%. But I guess that's still an improvement on the visibility that you would have otherwise. But yes, they've admitted that they need to speed up the process, and it's a very, very long way away from being in cars.
Interesting development.
Yeah.
I guess it's not something that we're going to see in cars, you know, next year.
No, but it's an interesting kind of thought process, I guess.
Yeah. Well, we're going to take an interesting thought process through our break that's about to happen. And when we come back, would you want to use ad-funded mobile broadband? We're going to get some answers.
Wired's second annual summit is coming. Following a sellout debut in 2011, Wired 2012 will feature an incredible lineup of speakers and thought-provoking talks over 2 days in London. The first names have already been announced, so find out more at wiredevent.co.uk.
Juicy break there. Thanks for bearing with us through it. So, Liv, you had a story in the site this week about a company called Samba that is developing, or has developed and is now selling, ad-funded mobile broadband. So you don't have to pay for the broadband, you just watch ads to earn minutes, I think.
Exactly. And they're kind of aiming this service for people with either laptops, netbooks or iPads, and you buy a dongle or you buy a micro SIM, and then you have to set up an account. And once you've done this, it will present you in the browser with a selection of ads. I think there's about six in a kind of grid. And the idea is that you select to watch one or a few of these ads, and for each one that you watch, there tend to be like video or viral sort of videos. Each one you watch, they'll give you a bit of an allocation of data. I think it's around 3.5 megabytes for each video that you watch. Okay. And they say that by watching just 2.5 minutes of ads per day, you can get around 517 meg of data in a month, which is the average amount that a 3G tablet consumer uses, according to some Cisco research. For any heavy users, it's not going to be enough, I don't think.
But you could, I assume you could probably just watch more ads to earn more data.
You can watch more ads, or you can top up with just buying top-ups for, I think it's 500 meg for £5.99. So
I think this is a really interesting business model. When you first started talking to me about it in the office early this week, it did get me thinking that this is actually something I think a lot of people could use. I mean, Duncan, would you want to do this? Would you want to...
Well, no, basically. I mean, this is, they're talking about 2.5 minutes of ads a day, and they've done that quite cleverly, because 2.5 minutes of ads a day is what? Almost an hour's worth of ads over the course of a month, isn't it? Mm. So you watch an hour of ads and you still get probably not quite enough data to last. It says the average consumer, so, you know, half of the people who use it will need more than that.
But I'll tell you something.
And you're watching an hour of nonsense.
But they use this technique a lot in airports. So you can go to an airport and you can connect to their free Wi-Fi, but you have to watch a short, it's usually about 30 seconds, little video or something of one of their sponsors. You know, it's usually a telecoms provider or hotel, yeah, or something like that. And I have, on occasion, found myself being more than happy that I'll keep the ad there, I'll watch it, whatever, and then I get, you know, 20 minutes of free Wi-Fi or something, yeah, to check email.
And 2.5 minutes, I mean, that's just the same as a single ad break when you're watching a TV program. So yeah, I think you can put up with that.
I mean, to be honest, I've completely stopped watching TV because there's far too many ads on it as it is already.
But what about the web? And if you're at the web all day.
Well, yeah, but, you know, I can actually look at the content and not the ads. The point is that, you know, you watch an ad and you get 3.5 megs of data. That's barely a YouTube video. You know, that's not very much.
But if it's a case of being out and about, you don't have any Wi-Fi access, and you can get a bit of free internet connection just by watching a few minutes of ads, I can see this being quite a good little exchange, a value exchange. I don't think that's a value exchange you're prepared to make, but I think many people will.
I think there are a lot of people out there who, you know, can maybe justify buying an iPad, but can't necessarily justify buying a data plan, particularly if they're already paying for one on their mobile phone, and networks still these days don't let you split that single data allowance across multiple devices. You have to buy additional data plans for additional devices. Now, I can see people in that position saying, well, I'll have this SIM just in my iPad, and maybe once a month I just need to find an email, I just need to check, is the train on time? And, you know, maybe they've got a couple of minutes to watch an ad, and they can do that, and it costs them nothing. I think that is a very attractive proposition. Yeah.
Now, one of the things you were worried about was whether they were going to be looking at the websites that you were looking at and trying to use that to target the ads.
Yeah.
Now, I spoke to the founder, Ben Atherton, and he specifically said, no, they won't be doing that. What they will be doing is looking at you. You have to enter some details when you set up your account, and you have to say, you know, your gender and your age, etc. And they will also be looking at the ads that you're selecting and then try and deliver you ads that were similar to the ones you picked. The idea for on the advertiser side is that people are actually actively selecting to watch their ads. I mean, how active that sort of exchange is another question altogether. But they will say that it's more valuable to get someone to click on their ad and pick it out of a grid of six than for just to be forced to watch it on as a pre or post roll on a video.
I think in lighter use cases scenarios, they're probably right.
Yeah.
You know, if I had to watch pre-rolls on a video website, and I could at least pick, I don't want to watch pre-roll ads about beauty products, reality TV and pop music. I want to see ones about maybe documentaries and consumer technology and, I don't know, mobile phone offers or something. Then I probably would choose that. And I would be a more valued pair of eyeballs to that advertiser.
Mm. To be honest, if I want to just go and find some information out in a hurry on my, you know, portable device or whatever, the last thing I want to do is have to sit there and watch 3 minutes of ads before I do it.
But you can clock it up in advance so that you've got credit. You can kind of aggregate this credit so you can use it whenever you want.
I don't know. I don't see people actually doing that.
Well, I guess we'll see.
They've had a trial, I think, for a little while. Didn't you try it for a bit?
I've been trying it this week. It's pretty easy to use. I mean, it's nowhere near the amount of data that I would need in a month, and I'd have to watch a lot of ads. And the problem at the moment is they don't have enough advertisers to supply that number of ads. So it's in the early stages, and I reckon they will get a lot more, but I don't know if you'll... And they don't have an upper cap on the number of ads you can watch. It's just the number of ads deals that they do with the advertisers.
Yeah. Well, we've got more details on the website. If you search for Samba, S-A-M-B-A. Wasn't there a thing in a cartoon called Samba?
Oh, Simba. Oh, it's worth adding that it's on 3's 3G network is how you get the...
So it's actually worth using then. Only because I'm on 3. We asked for some feedback. We had one interesting bit of feedback on this actually on Facebook from Paul Price, didn't we, Liv?
Yes, he said 3 ads is great, i.e. the average number you have to watch to get that amount of data, except I would need to watch 30 to get enough data. Also, I've had mobile broadband with 3 before, and it is a joke.
Interesting. But he's obviously a power user. You know, he's not the clientele they're necessarily targeting, I suppose.
No, he isn't. And we've had other people who've come out in support of 3's data network. So
One must ask what he is going to be doing with that broadband. Maybe watching TV, Duncan.
Yes, maybe using UView, which will be launching before the end of July.
What's UView?
UView.
Why should I care?
Well, UView is an attempt that's been in the works for a long, long time, from the BBC, from ITV, from Channel 4 and Channel 5, BT, TalkTalk, and a communications infrastructure company called Arquiva, to offer on-demand and catch-up television through broadband connections. A little bit like Freeview, but over the internet.
So a bit more like iPlayer, but for all the channels.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. There'll be a program guide for upcoming shows that you can watch, but you'll also be able to go backwards 7 days to watch shows that you've missed.
This is awesome. I mean, I really like the sound of this. Why should I not be pulling my wallet out of my capacious jeans?
Well, because it's going to cost you £300.
Stay there, wallet. You're not required.
So just to kind of reiterate, this is just bringing together all the stuff that you can already get on your laptop.
Correct.
And just putting it in one place.
In one place, yes.
So I guess the benefits are it's searchable in one place, but actually all the content's out there, probably with better interface across all the different separate.
Yes, correct. I mean, basically, UView started life years and years and years ago as Project Kangaroo, and then it became Project something else, and then
it leapt through the names, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. And then in 2010, it was in such dire straits that Alan Sugar got brought on board to either kill it or make it work, and he seems to have made it work. But the problem is that it's been delayed so long now that the various broadcast providers now have developed in-house all their own services to do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
Like, if it had launched in 2010 when it had originally planned to, it would have been amazing. But because it's been delayed so long, it's basically useless. And the fact that they're charging £300 for the set-top boxes to enable it, it's a bit of a joke, to be honest.
But I see that there is a real value to it to a lot of people, though, having all this in one place with one interface. That's definitely going to win over some people.
Yeah, but I mean, all the functionality that it offers is available kind of through various other things online at the moment free.
But not necessarily through a TV and not necessarily with
anyone who's got kind of Virgin boxes and Sky boxes hooked up to their connections will have services like this already available.
But I guess it's probably not for those people, right? This is for people who maybe aren't as well versed in the ways of IPTV, and it's just a very easy way without a subscription to get access to everything in a very kind of simple
way. That's a very nice, polite way of saying our parents.
Yeah, exactly.
But that is the case, though, right?
But what was the initial kind of business case for doing this? Why were they doing it in the first place?
There was a competition thing, wasn't there? Because the BBC had such dominance with iPlayer. And I think a lot of the networks wanted to have some kind of equal footing. I'm sure that was a factor in the early days, at least in Kangaroo.
I think so, yeah, definitely. What I think is quite interesting is, although the set-top boxes are initially going to cost £300, TalkTalk and BT have promised later this year to roll out much, much more heavily subsidised versions to their customers. Obviously, TalkTalk and BT provide broadband, and so that the customers on that broadband will probably get a really cheap set-top box that they can plug in. It'll go over those networks and it'll cost a lot less. And I think that's the area that I think we'll see a bit more pickup. You know,
yeah.
People like our parents who have got BT connections and TalkTalk connections and don't, you know, necessarily want to, you know, watch stuff on their computers, but would like to watch something on their televisions, and making a low-cost set-top box available to those people will make it easier for them. So it's
I think
not...
you basically just described my mum, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I mean, again, as always, we're interested in hearing what you think. If this is something that, you know, do you think £300 is too much for all of these catch-up services in one place on one TV? Let us know.
And if you don't, tell us why.
Yeah, tell us why too. podcast@wired.co.uk. Very keen to hear what you think. And that wraps it up for another week, like a little present with a ribbon on the top, such as Liv might be opening later on her birthday.
Fingers crossed.
So for your birthday present, Duncan's going to read out all the contact details.
Yay!
you should follow us on Twitter. We are @WiredUK, and we are on Facebook too, facebook.com/WiredUK. As we've mentioned several times through the podcast, you can email us, podcast@wired.co.uk, or if you want to leave us a voicemail message, you can call Wired UK Podcast on Skype or 0208 123 0468 from a landline or mobile.
And we should probably point out as well that the magazine has a new issue out as of today.
Yes.
This week. It's got a big picture of Jack Dorsey on the front. He's the guy who founded Twitter. He's now come up with an ingenious way to take on the banks. And we've got an incredibly large, detailed feature with him about how he's intending to do that. So do go and check it out. It's on the App Store as well, on iTunes if you have an iPad. And on that note, we will see you in another week.
Goodbye.
Bye.
Don't twiddle if you don't need to. That's been my rule.